This is VOA News via remote. I'm Gene Randall. Health officials have seen troubling spikes in coronavirus cases in Russia, India, and Pakistan. Almost 10,000 in Russia, 20% higher than the previous day. The country now has officially topped 124,000 suspected COVID-19 cases. The death toll is 1,200 in a half dozen regions, including the Moscow area. Because virus test results in Russia are widely considered to be unreliable, the actual numbers could be much higher. Among those stricken by COVID-19, Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin, who says he has temporarily stepped away from running the cabinet. A growing fear in Russia that its medical system cannot handle a surge in corona infections. And Moscow's mayor says there is a plan to use sports stadiums as temporary hospitals. In Pakistan, nearly 1,300 new COVID-19 cases have been reported, pushing its total caseload to 18,700. It may be connected to increased testing. Prime Minister Imran Khan has set a goal of 20,000 tests a day. His government says it may soon erase some pandemic controls, but health officials are warning that could lead to an explosion of new infections that would overwhelm Pakistan's healthcare system. Some officials are urging even stricter controls. The country has lost a reported 432 lives to the outbreak. India has recorded its worst daily new case number, 2,300, bringing its total cases to well over 37,000 and more than 1,200 deaths. India's 1.3 billion people have been under lockdown because of the virus, and it's been extended to May 17th, though there's been an easing of restrictions, which is expected to continue in the coming week. Meanwhile, the coronavirus continues its relentless assault on the world and its people. There have been close to 3.4 million cases reported by Johns Hopkins University in 187 countries and regions. The death toll has now risen above 240,000. Pandemic figures here in the U.S. are almost beyond belief. 1.1 million cases and over 65,000 lives lost. This is VOA News. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has given emergency approval to the use of the antiviral drug remdesivir, which in tests has reduced COVID patients' average recovery time from 15 days to 11 days, and some believe in the process has probably saved lives. America's preeminent expert on infectious diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, was scheduled to testify next week before a Democratic-led House committee looking into the nation's coronavirus response. But the White House says that will not happen, that the time is not right. It appears Fauci will be allowed to appear before a Republican-led Senate committee. He's been preaching the risks of reopening the U.S. economy too quickly, a view seemingly at odds with one espoused by President Donald Trump, who has been pushing governors to quickly get their states back in business. The U.S. this weekend is in the initial stages of reopening its severely damaged economy. Several governors are lifting stay-at-home orders, despite the advice of medical authorities, who say they risk setting off a new wave of COVID infections. Among the states opening up, Texas, even though its number of virus cases this week has spiked. In the group of more cautious governors, Andrew Cuomo of New York and J.B. Pritzker of Illinois, who say their statewide restrictions will stay in effect until conditions are safer. There have been more than 308,000 cases of coronavirus in New York, with over 24,000 lives lost, and the state is still averaging about 900 COVID hospitalizations a day. Illinois' numbers, 56,000 cases and a death toll close to 2,500. France, Spain, and Germany have announced they are partially reopening their societies as new COVID cases decline. The moves coincide with the arrival of beautiful spring weather, which is bringing large numbers of people outside as pandemic rules are relaxed. France, Spain, and Germany have a combined 545,000 coronavirus cases with 56,000 deaths. Italy is maintaining its shutdown for now, its 28,000 COVID fatalities, the highest outside the United States. China has removed its blanket restrictions that kept 800 million people at home, but is continuing with extensive fever testing and other monitoring. China today announced one new case of COVID-19. A U.S. federal judge has thrown out the $66 million claim by the U.S. women's national soccer team that its players are victims of unequal pay under an existing collective bargaining agreement. But the court says it will allow the defending world champion team to proceed to trial with an allegation of discriminatory travel accommodations and medical support services. U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres says COVID-19 is causing untold fear and suffering for older people around the world. For those over 80, the fatality rate is 5 times the global average. More news at voanews.com. There is also a mobile app for your listening convenience. I'm Gene Randall. Via remote, this is VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
To try and find any excuse whatsoever to lock me up. And this is where it's heading. This is what they've been trying to do for the last 2 years, is try to lock me up under some false accusation or other.
A former Botswana president denies embezzling public funds.
And remember that Mutharika has appealed against the decision of the Constitutional Court. So the moment that he agrees to fire the chairperson or to fire the entire team of the commissioners, then his appeal in the Supreme Court would not make sense.
A former vice president endorses incumbent Malawian president Arthur Peter Mutharika ahead of the upcoming July election.
We believe the Kanute government needs to take steps to regain confidence of the population. It has to do this if it is going to get the population to make sacrifices. So it's better to focus attention on what we need to do now rather than what we ought to have done in the past.
And a major Nigerian group demands transparency and accountability in the fight against the coronavirus. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Serete Kama Ian Kama, a former Botswana president, has sharply denied reports he siphoned millions of dollars of public funds into foreign accounts. Local media reports that court papers filed by the government accused the former president and two of his associates of transferring over $400 million of public funds from the Bank of Botswana into offshore accounts. But the former president and his associates have denied the accusations. Mr. Kama said the accusations appear to have started after he resigned from the ruling Botswana Democratic Party, or BDP, before last year's elections. His resignation came following differences with President Mokgweetsi Masisi. The former president tells me that his lawyers will soon file a suit against any person who he says played a key role in accusing him of embezzling public funds and transferring them into private accounts overseas.
Yes, so what happened was that this arose from the fact that I left the current regime, I mean as a political party, and then the leader decided that he was going to fix me for having done that. And he said that to two people who came and told me to their face that this is what he says he's going to do. So the next thing we hear was that there's an affidavit written by one of the agents in the security services to the effect that I had whistled away an equivalent of around $10 billion back in 2008, which was probably about 2 months or 3 months. They said in the month of June. So that would have been 2 to 3 months after I took office. And then instructed people in our national bank, the Bank of Botswana, to go and put all this money in a number of accounts offshore. And that basically was a story. They implicated two or three other people as well. So up to now, they have not been able to provide a shred of truth for the only reason that that never happened. So I've said, no, that's fine. I'm going to make them regret that they have departed from the good governance that this country has always been proud of, the democratic credentials we have built up for so many years, that they will resort to this kind of fabrication against an opponent. So I'm going to sue them, and on top of that, I'm going to lay criminal charges against those officials who came up with that affidavit. So right now, we have a team of lawyers, of those who had been accused with this fabricated story by this regime, and they're working together. And then we are going to put out, once they've got all the information, we've already collected information from some of the banks to where some of these monies were claimed to have been deposited. Those banks have come out and said that no such accounts exist, no such monies were deposited in their banks. Even our national bank said they're not missing any money at all. And even the most ridiculous thing about the claim was that we never had, that national bank never had that order of magnitude of money anyway. So this was just something so ridiculous and amateurish for them to have tried to do just to get at me. So we are going to come out with a report and we're going to go public with it. And then after that, we're going to sue them and lay criminal charges.
Mr. President, we also understand there is a plan to overthrow the current government in Botswana and that you are intrinsically involved in the plan because of your sharp disagreement with the current president. Are you planning to overthrow the government in Botswana?
If there is a plan to overthrow this regime, I certainly don't know about it, and I would not be part of it anyway. But I think I know enough about what's going on in this country to say confidently that that kind of allegation is totally false. Having grown up in this country, having had my father who was the founding president, having been the president myself, there's no way that I would want to have a reputation of having been someone who would have overthrown a regime of this type. You know, there are many ways in a democracy that one can get rid of a government which people are increasingly becoming unhappy with, and that is at an election. And at the end of the day, it'll be people who will make up their minds as to how far and for how long they're going to put up with the situation we have here.
Mr. President, what are your thoughts about the state of emergency that has been extended by Parliament?
My opinion about the state of emergency was that it's heavy-handed, it's unnecessary. The most countries around the world, as you're aware, have got put in place lockdowns in one form or the other. But here, it wasn't Parliament actually. They actually passed what he wanted to do for a period of 6 months. And you say, why 6 months? Because a state of emergency gives him powers that he's able to use. And when I first responded, when I was asked about this question by someone else, I just said I hope the state of emergency will be used to fight the virus and not to be used to fight anything or anyone else. So, like I said, short of it is that I think it's heavy-handed and that's unnecessary because the people here would have been fully willing to cooperate with your normal lockdown process.
Some opposition groups have criticized the government for using the state of emergency as well as the fight against the disease to clamp down on freedom of speech or clamp down on dissent. They cited instances of the spokesperson of the BPD, Justin Mutlambani, who was allegedly tortured and during a police investigation. What are your thoughts about accusations that a government is using the current prevailing conditions to clamp down on dissent?
That is something that concerned us at the time when the state of emergency was put in place, that it was going to be used to go after opponents. But I can tell you what happened to Justice, who is actually the BPF, there's the initials of the party he belongs to. That has happened before, but where it hasn't happened before is with previous administrations in this country. It is only now we are starting to see a form of autocratic rule, clamping down on opponents. We saw it in the lead up to the elections, where there were also allegations of rigging. And anybody who wants to talk out against the current person or his government, next thing you'll see an incident like this where the police descend upon them, the Botswana police, and then he had an opportunity to talk to his lawyers and others when he was granted bail and raised allegations that when he was being questioned by the police, they resorted to torturing him. And those kind of things have never happened or don't happen in Botswana. And if any policeman exercise that kind of action against a member of the public in the past, serious action would be taken against them. So we'll wait to see what the response is in this instance. But obviously he was targeted because he's an opponent. And it's just so unfortunate that a country like ours, which has enjoyed and practiced democracy and considers human rights to be so vital in the way we used to do our day-to-day business, to start seeing all that being eroded now is such a shame. And I guess you may have heard his interview that he gave after he was released on bail, outlining what happened to him and how they were trying to ask him questions, including about me, to say that did he know if I was planning a coup, which is just so ridiculous that they continue with this constant thing of a coup to try and find any excuse whatsoever to lock me up. And this is where it's heading. This is what they've been trying to do for the last 2 years, is try to lock me up under some false accusation or other.
Seretse Khama Ian Khama is a former Botswana president. He spoke with me from the capital, Gaborone. A Malawian governance consultant says the endorsement from Kassim Chulumpa, a former vice president, is unlikely to significantly boost the re-election bid of incumbent president Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika. Vincent Kondwi says the former vice president does not have the political clout to enable the president to defeat the opposition alliance. Announcing the endorsement, former vice president Chulumpa says the president is the best person to improve the living conditions of the poor. He also accused the opposition of greed and self-centeredness. Governance consultant Vincent Kondwi tells me that the endorsement is not generating the needed buzz or excitement to catapult the president to victory in July.
Very much inconsequential. Here is a former vice president who twice has failed to win a seat as a member of parliament in his constituency. Therefore, his endorsement does not appeal or speak to any constituency apart from maybe his few members of his political party. And again, I might say his political party is only a briefcase party. It's only on paper. There's nothing on the ground, no structures, literally nothing. Hence, we can conclude that it's very much inconsequential.
Inconsequential, as you say, the endorsement is. Ruling party supporters are hailing it as a significant gesture that will boost the alliance with the UDF to win the upcoming July presidential election rerun. What is your take?
Well, the ruling party supporters may say whatever they want to say. Maybe because they are at their lowest point in terms of popularity. But the truth of the matter is that in terms of bringing the votes to the DPP-UDF alliance, I do not believe that Kassim Chilumpa's endorsement is anything of significance. Strictly speaking, it is only very symbolic and a kind of a token endorsement, not really something that would substantively change the political terrain or sway a significant number of votes to the DPP-UDF alliance.
Talking about the political terrain, do you think that the ruling party stands a chance of winning re-election led by incumbent president Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika, particularly when Nicholas Dawsey, the spokesman for the ruling party, as well as the Home Affairs Minister, is adamant that they won the election that was cancelled and they were going to win it again?
Well, in Africa, there is a lot of incumbency advantages. They have got access to state resources. They control institutions that matter in the electoral process. In this case, the Malawi Electoral Commission and the state broadcaster, the Malawi Broadcasting Corporation. They have got unlimited use of all available government resources to their advantage. Even when the president goes out to campaign, he uses all the state machinery available to them. Hence, even if when a ruling party in Africa has its popularity gone very, very down, you cannot
rule out. Again, the ruling DPP and President Arthur Peter Mutharika are wounded buffaloes. They have suffered defeat at the hands of the constitutional court. And when you combine that and look at the levels and the deep state that they have created, and when you look at the corruption allegations, I think they would fight with their backs to the wall and with all their might to make sure that they win. So when Honorable Nicholas Dawusi says that they're going to win, well, fine and good. They are the ruling party, and you expect him to speak like that, given the background that I've provided. But from an analytical perspective, I feel like the DPP will suffer a protest vote from the people. They have not delivered on their manifesto. They promised a lot in 2014, but 5 years which they ruled from 2014 to 2019 was quite a huge blow to the Malawi population, to the extent that almost all services, health, education, infrastructure, and people having no money really to live barely above the dollar line per day. So for me, it's very, very difficult for them to win. And again, when you look at the MCP-UTM alliance, I think it is a huge alliance, and the DPP will really have to work very, very hard if they have to reclaim their political power.
What are your thoughts about the Public Affairs Committee's effort to have a dialogue between the opposition and civil society groups and government to resolve any issues before the elections? Because one of the cardinal requests and demand by the opposition is that the current chairperson or the composition of the Electoral Commission should be changed in order for credible presidential election rerun to be held. Do you think their efforts could be successful?
Firstly, I am drawn to the scheme of our elections administration legal framework. You know, our electoral laws make a candidate who is going to compete in an election to be the appointing authority of the commissioners that constitute the Malawi Electoral Commission. So the way that our laws are framed are a bit of a problem. For example, Mutharika was the final authority that appointed Justice Jane Ansah to be the chairperson of the Electoral Commission. And him was a candidate competing in the same elections in 2019. And then the same Electoral Commission declared him to be the winning candidate. There is an inherent conflict for him to arrive at the difficult decision of firing the very same Electoral Commission chairperson whom he appointed, who declared him the winner. And then the moment he turns around and agrees to fire the MEC chairperson, he will be like endorsing the idea that the current crop of the commissioners did not do their job properly. He will be like completely in agreement with the decision of the Constitutional Court that said that they did not conduct the elections in the way as provided for by the law. And remember that Mutharika has appealed against the decision of the Constitutional Court. So the moment that he agrees to fire the chairperson or to fire the entire team of the commissioners, then his appeal in the Supreme Court would not make sense.
Vincent Kondwe is a governance consultant in Malawi. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. In Nigeria, the Northern Elders Forum, a political pressure group, is calling for transparency in the fight against the coronavirus. This after President Muhammadu Buhari announced a two-week lockdown and an investigation into deaths in Kano State, the largest city in the north. The city had recently seen a sharp rise in deaths due in large part to pneumonia. But political parties and other stakeholders say an investigation is needed to determine whether the hundreds of deaths could be related to the coronavirus. Dr. Hakim Baba, spokesperson for the Northern Elders Forum, tells me that transparency is needed in the fight to contain the spread of the virus and added that this is not the time for politics.
The Northern Elders Forum has followed developments in Kano very, very closely, in particular because Kano represents a major source of concern. The numbers that have been spiking with levels of alarm and the concerns that a lot of deaths could be attributed to coronavirus. We released a statement that appreciated the efforts of the federal government, appreciated the efforts of the international community, invited attention to the need for the Kano State government to open up its medical establishments, but first of all to address the needs of the medical personnel, PPEs, personal protection equipment, and improvements in facilities that are available. It is absolutely vital that Kano is addressed with some vigor, some transparency, and a lot of resources. Kano needs to keep people at home by deploying resources to support people who stay at home. Kano is vital to the fight against coronavirus. If we lose Kano, then the country is in trouble.
Dr. Hakim, there are also concerns that some people are playing politics with the presence of COVID-19 in Kano, and that a section of the population is accusing the government of not being proactive or doing enough to arrest the situation, while others are saying the government is doing everything it can to address the situation. What is the position or the stance of the Northern Elders Forum regarding this?
Well, we are worried that this is basically a reflection of poor management of public information. Weeks back, we think that the Kano State government ought to have taken decisive steps to deal with perception issues, concerns on the part of the population, ignorance, to be perfectly honest, and also the people who appeared to be looking for evidence that coronavirus really exists, as well as the number of deaths that were occurring that many people thought were unusual. We thought it was important that the Kano State government moved quickly to deal with some of these concerns. As a result of that, there's some distance that has grown between the government and the people, and a lot of people think this is political. We don't think we should play politics with this. We don't want to play politics with this, but we believe that the government of Kano State needs to take steps to bridge the gap between itself and its own people. One, it needs trust to keep people at home. Two, it needs to put resources behind its lockdown orders. And three, it needs to show evidence that it can also use its own resources rather than wait for other people's resources, even if it belongs to the people of Kano State as well, so that it can do something to reopen facilities, buy some equipment, and address the concerns of people. We believe Kano State government needs to do a lot of work in order to regain the confidence of the people.
Dr. Hakim, in your earlier submission, you talked about transparency. What will the Northern Elders Forum want to see regarding transparency in addressing this issue of the spread of the disease and regarding the infrastructural needs that have to be taken in order to meet the challenges posed by the spread of this disease?
Well, first of all, there's enough integrity and responsibility within the community of Kano State. We believe in the particular instance of Kano State, there will be some value in the government involving persons of high integrity and high caliber people to be involved in everything it does regarding the fight against coronavirus. We believe that it should involve leaders in the community and other people who can add value to what its efforts are in terms of public education. And we believe that there is room to involve other people who are other than government officials in the distribution of palliatives. These are absolutely essential because the government needs to recover a lot of ground in the manner it deals with the public. This is a fight that cannot be lost. And the fulcrum, the whole basis of the government winning this war really depends on how much room creates in terms of regaining confidence, opening up facilities, telling people the truth about this death, and just simply being out there and letting people see that everything it does, it's honest, it's sincere, and it's open.
Some Nigerians are critical of both the Kano State government and the federal government of not being proactive enough, especially with the type of talent and the resources, medical resource personnel that Nigeria has. It is regrettable, they said, that both governments have not been proactive to address the spread of this disease until people started raising alarm about the alarming rate of death in Kano. What is the position of the Northern Elders Forum about this?
Well, see, at this stage, to be honest, it's more practical to just look ahead. A lot of mistakes have been made. A lot of turning points have been missed. There's no point going back to things that ought to have happened, things we should have done, things we didn't do. The federal government, the state governments, everybody has made some terrible mistakes, particularly in a high-density place like Kano. What is important now is to focus on what do we need to do. We think the federal government is taking the right steps. It's mobilizing resources to assist Kano state government. It is not handing over money. It is going to use those resources to procure equipment and to improve the protection of medical personnel. It should do this promptly and as quickly as possible. We believe that the Kano state government has a role to play. It needs to move quickly to regain the confidence of the medical personnel, keep them properly, to reopen facilities that can address non-COVID cases that need help. We believe the Kano state government needs to take steps to regain confidence of the population. It has to do this if it is going to get the population to make sacrifices. So it's better to focus attention on what we need to do now rather than what we ought to have done in the past.
Dr. Hakim Baba is the spokesperson for the Northern Elders Forum. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Chad, an opposition party has launched a petition seeking to amend the constitution to allow its presidential candidate to participate in next year's general election. The Transformers Party says recent changes to the constitution, which requires a candidate to be at least 45 years old to compete in the presidential election, is discriminatory. But supporters of the ruling party say the new age restriction will ensure only mature, qualified candidates will be allowed to compete. They dismiss suggestions that the country's leaders, including President Idris Deby, came to power when they were less than 45 years old. Dr. Ndolembai Njesada Sade is the vice president in charge of diaspora and bilateral relations for the opposition Transformers Party. He tells me that the constitutional changes also weaken the country's burgeoning democracy.
Yes, this petition that was launched is to raise awareness about believing in democracy, and we want to really inform the national as well as the international community about the discrepancy that exists in our constitution by raising the bar regarding the age to participate in the election to 45 years old, knowing very well that none of the charging presidents, from the first president to the current president, none of them came to the power at the age of 45. So the petition is to allow our political party leader, Dr. Sixi Master, to be able to participate in the election that's coming up in 2021 in Chad.
Some people are suggesting that a constitutional amendment was due to your presidential candidate, since he might not have attained the age of 45 to meet the constitutional requirement. What is so bad about it, since Parliament overwhelmingly voted unanimously to amend the constitution? What can he do about this?
So the amendment of Article 68 of the constitution that happened shortly after the creation of our movement, the Transformateur, that became a political party, is commonly known nowadays as anti-master clause, simply because as soon as we launched this movement back then 2 years ago, and one day today to be exact, it caught a lot of tractions. And given that this clause targeted our leader, but indirectly it's targeting 80% of the Chadian population to run for presidency, because 80% of those 15 or 16 million people are under the age of 45. So this is why we are raising the awareness, we are sounding the alarm on the national as well as the international level that this is not the democracy. We are not in a democratic country. So we need to change this by speaking to on network like yours in order to raise awareness about this.
How pragmatic is your petition to change or amend the constitution as it stands? Because we understand that representatives from the country in parliament voted for this change. So how pragmatic is this, since the government controls a majority in parliament?
This petition is historical. It's never done before in this country, and it's challenging the current regime. One thing we know, based on this constitution, we're not in a democratic country. Yes, by name, it could be said as a democratic country, but looking at the Fourth Republic, we're far left from being a democratic nation. So this petition, if it reached its objective, will bring back the country in its initial point, where we'll start talking about democracy and moving forward. And on top of that, you can see that the African Union Charter of the Youth amends the implication of the youth into the democratic movement within the continent. Unfortunately, they have been silent since this petition, this amendment has been voted by the majority of the parliament that is led by the ruling party. So it is crucial for all Chadians from the diaspora or here in the country to be aware of what's going on and to speak up. And that's what we're doing. And not only that, but we're raising awareness within the diplomatic institution as well, so that we can stand and raise the flag of democracy within this nation. Because we know, and all Chadians know, that if there is an election in 2021 without Le Transformateur, then that's not a credible election. That is not a democratic election.
Supporters of the ruling party are saying that your call for international help to amend the constitution is compared to inviting them to influence or interfere in the internal political dynamics of Chad, which they said is unpatriotic and regrettable. How do you respond to that?
I do not believe that we are calling the international community to amend the constitution in any shape or form. You know very well that many, if not all, of the African countries request financial support for international institutions every time they organize an election. We are all for a credible and useful election in this nation. And we know, as many of those international communities support or finance those elections within different countries in Africa, and specifically in the case here, we want them to know that we are not in a democratic situation, a position at the moment. We know in Chad that there is no separation of power. This is a pure dynasty that we're living in. And for the taxpayer money of the European Union to caution such action, I would say it's criminal. That's the reason why we're raising this awareness, for them to realize that, you know, they need to require at least the minimum of the separation of power within a democracy before they can fund even partially the election in Chad. So to us, part of this democratic movement should allow anyone who's 18 and above to be able to participate in an election if they are willing to. Why would you allow somebody who's at least 18 years old to fight against Boko Haram to defend the color of the nation, but you will tell somebody who's 44 years old that he's too young to run for the presidency? This is the discrepancy we're talking about. And this is anti-democratic. And that's why we want to make sure this is looked at all level, nationally as well as internationally. We are not calling the international community for an amendment.
Dr. Ndolembai Njeseda Sade is the vice president in charge of diaspora and bilateral relations for the Opposition Transformers Party. He spoke with me from the Chadian capital in N'Djamena. The Egyptian National Action Group, a political pressure organization, has petitioned the IMF to implement an accountability mechanism before granting loans to the Egyptian government. The group says objectives of previous loans have failed to meet targets, including alleviating poverty in the North African country. The remarks come after Egypt applied to the IMF seeking funds to help in the fight to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Yehia Hamed, a former Egyptian minister for investment, tells me that transparency and accountability are key to ensuring the loans get to their intended targets.
A few years back, the IMF gave Egypt $12 billion. It was in 2016, and it was meant that it helped the structure change that would impact each one's life, as well as closing the deficits of the government. What happened after those 4 years is that we are having around $120 billion worth of loans, and this is almost tripling the external debt of Egypt since 2013. And what we are having is that 6 out of 10 people are poor or on the verge of poverty, according to the World Bank. The IMF needs to question itself. What really happened during these years, other than the nice story that the regime is saying, that we closed deficit, etc., etc., what really happened on the normal day-to-day life of the Egyptian people is that poor people are get poorer, military and the regime are getting a domination of the business altogether. This is what we call accountability. If you really give money, it needs to be impacted or reflected on each one's daily life.
Are you therefore suggesting that the loans the IMF might give to Egypt might not necessarily be used to fight the spread of COVID-19?
Egypt has started talks with the IMF in January 2020, and the government has said that they have been trying to ask for another round of loans after the $12 billion loan they got in 2016. So it has nothing to do with the COVID-19. They can use it under the pretext of COVID-19, but it has nothing to do with it. It is, again, to cover the deficit under what the IMF is calling restructure, a change of economy. And again, the normal people will be experimenting another wave of poverty, another wave of economical oppression. Egyptian government has been removing the subsidy, which has been there for decades right now, without introducing proper safety nets for the poor, which means that a lot of the middle class people, as well as the poorer class people, will have a more tight situation in the coming few months.
What do you say to supporters of the government who are of the view that your accusations are neither here nor there, and that there are poor people everywhere in the world, and that the criticisms you are leveling against the government about the misapplication of funds are untrue, and that they were implemented fully to help the poor, and that not everybody was alleviated from poverty, which is common in situations across the world?
When millions of people went to the street in 2011, when they removed the late President Hosni Mubarak, I was one of them. We dreamt of social justice, we dreamt of better life, we dreamt about the rule of law, and we dreamt about a better future for everyone. 9 years down the road, nothing of this have been fulfilled. Another military regime has been taking over. They can claim whatever they can claim. Numbers do not lie. At the end of the day, we have 17% increase of poverty rate in only 3 years. We are having, according to Carnegie Endowment report, a massive domination of economy into the hands of the military, which has definitely impacted the private sector and the FDIs coming to Egypt. Only in the last couple of weeks, we have 9.5 billion dollars have went out of Egypt because it has only been invested in hot money and stock market, which again indicates how volatile the real economy is. I wish this was true, that we are having good economy, but reality is not, and the IMF is only giving political support for a military junta regime that is definitely, by at the end of the day, will be faced by normal people and mass resentment.
Some civil society groups are calling for more accountability by the administration. They are calling on the IMF to put in stringent accountability mechanisms. What is your stance about this and the government drive to seek funds to help in the fight against COVID-19 or the disease in the country at the moment?
Peter, Egypt during the past few years have really come very low in the investment in the health sector, for example. We don't have enough hospitals. We don't have enough doctors. There are several reports that are saying that almost 50% of the working capacity of physicians have immigrated from Egypt in the last decade only, which is quite scary as well. So if the IMF is willing to put funds into fighting COVID-19, then it needs to be invested definitely in the health sector and definitely in the educational sector. Let me tell you that Egypt is probably one of the first countries in the arm imports from countries like France, like Russia, etc., but definitely is not coming anywhere in the education as well as in the health sector, which is extremely of vital role now. No one can tell you where the 12 billion that the Egyptian regime in 2011 took have went or have been invested. There is no reports about that at all. It's only have been used to cover the deficits.
Yahya Hamed is a former Egyptian minister for investment. He spoke with me from Istanbul, Turkey. Ugandan prison authorities have started releasing more than 800 prisoners who were pardoned this week by President Yoweri Museveni. It's part of efforts to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in congested prisons. For VOA, Kathleen Nambi reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
The list that prison authorities presented to the Mercy Committee for Presidential Pardon had 2,000 names. Exercising his constitutional powers, President Yoweri Museveni zeroed on just a fraction from 259 prison facilities across the country. Frank Baine is the Uganda prison spokesperson. He confirmed the presidential pardon.
President signed an instrument sanctioning the pardon of the 833. And as we are talking, the list has just come back to us through the Attorney General to confirm those who were removed, those who remained, and now the process for having them released is on, because these prisoners are coming from all over the country.
Baine says some of those being released include inmates who have been serving sentences not exceeding 2 years, others who have served more than two-thirds of their sentences, and the breastfeeding mothers. However, Nicholas Opiyo, a human rights lawyer, thinks the number being released is too small to help decongest Uganda's prisons.
People who have overstayed on remand awaiting trials, people who are terminally ill and are just waiting for their day to die, all of these individuals need to be released from prison immediately. We hope that the president can see the logic in the fact that if he wants to avert a possibility of COVID attacking prisons or infecting prisoners, he has to release at least 3,000 prisoners.
But prison spokesperson Baine says the number is significant.
The numbers may not be look so big, but any reduction on the numbers is very welcome and appreciated. Fortunately, it touches all prisons in the country. And so we expect that when you arrest 800, that 800 number, you normally accumulate it in normal times, you accumulate it in about a month or about 2 months.
Statistics say Uganda's prisons with a holding capacity of 20,000 inmates currently hold 64,000. It is feared such big numbers in the prison facilities makes them potential avenues for spread of COVID-19. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Thank you.
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, when a dying man cries, it is not because of where he is going, which he knows nothing about, but because of what he wishes he would have done in the world he is leaving behind. I am your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.